It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Volkswagen has only one car-making factory in the United States, and that's in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
The German automaker offered to allow its plant workers to unionize, but workers at the VW factory ultimately voted against union representation.
In an industry that's historically been intertwined with unions, what does the rejection of union representation in Chattanooga mean?
Here to help us put the story in context is Jonathan Pollack. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Cynthia. I'm glad to be here.
Well, get us up to speed a little bit on what happened in Chattanooga.
Okay, so what happened in Chattanooga was essentially, as you said in the intro, that there was a unionization drive in the VW plant. And what was different about this drive than most of them is that typically what happens when workers want to unionize is there's kind of an all-out push by management to stop that from happening. There's a sort of waiting period from the different parts of the process of certifying a union to represent workers in a particular plant. And during the gaps in that process, management tends to flood the zone with required lectures or films or guest speakers or a way to scare people out of actually voting to certify the union. What happened in Chattanooga that's unusual is that Volkswagen was kind of hands-off. They said, well, we have these works councils in Germany and at our other plants around the world. We think it's a decent way to run the business. In the United States, for reasons I'll talk about in a little bit, American labor law requires workers to be represented by like a legitimate union if there's a works council in place. So VW said, okay, so have your election, do what you want to do, and we're just going to kind of sit this out. So VW did not flood the zone with anti-labor propaganda. Instead, that fell to essentially the state of Tennessee, that the governor, the senator, some of the representatives of Congress, and other like outside activists, people like Grover Norquist, versatile sort of all-weather conservative activist, got involved buying billboards, trying to talk workers out of it and so forth. So it was a huge campaign outside of the plant. And then in the end, VW workers voted not to certify the UAW, leaving the whole thing kind of in limbo. Volkswagen seems to have been kind of stumped by this decision. And they're kind of saying, well, they're sort of thinking twice about expanding their U.S. operations if they can't even run the plant the way they want to.
Why was this a significant story?
Well, it was a significant story because, like I said, there's a certain kind the sides are kind of switched up that, you know, historically in union elections, if the election's taking place in an area that doesn't have a strong labor movement, doesn't have a historically strong labor movement, then maybe the state is kind of on the sidelines. Maybe state officials are kind of commenting. But usually what happens is even state politicians and local politicians who are not favorable to unions will kind of say, well, it's the choice of the workers who work there. They kind of back out of it, and it's the employer that's mounting the big anti-labor effort. At VW, the employer was like totally positive, and it was the state, it was politicians and activists who campaigned against it and convinced workers not to certify the union.
Yeah, but so, and as you say, it's up to the workers then to vote in this matter. What was it that convinced them not to do that? I mean, were they swayed? Did they feel threatened not to vote yes? So what was at play there?
Well, this is the huge question. I mean, this is what people, what labor journalists, labor historians, labor economists, labor union staff are trying to figure out. And as near as we can come from, as near as we can figure out, there are a whole bunch of different factors that kind of come into it. Part of it is the historic, very small role of unions in the South, especially industrial unions like the UAW. I mean, to provide a little context for it, labor historians, labor economists kind of talk about unions in two main groups. You've got your trade unions, you've got your industrial unions. Trade unions represent people in a particular trade or craft. So that's plumbers, it's carpenters, it's steam fitters. Those are traditionally represented by the American Federation of Labor, a labor union that goes back to the 1880s. Industrial workers, once you get to a factory, the difference between different trades gets kind of hard to figure out. You've got people who work in a warehouse. You've got people who work on assembly lines. You've got people who are cleaning the plant, et cetera. They're all kind of working for the same employer, and they're doing things that are relatively interchangeable, don't require a great amount of skill and training in a particular craft. So industrial unionism came about in the 1930s through the Congress of Industrial Organizations, or the CIO. The AFL and CIO merged in the 1950s so that all of the unions under the CIO, like the UAW, the United Auto Workers, the union in question here, became part of the same labor federation with the Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners, steam fitters, and other trade unions. So part of the context is that this idea of industrial unionism that I talked about wasn't really present in the South. During the era that the CIO was organizing in the industrial north of the United States, in Chicago, in Milwaukee, in Janesville, all across the state of Michigan and Ohio, there wasn't that much industry in the South. Industries were beginning to move southward, beginning with textiles in the early 20th century. The textile plant owners looking at labor organization in textile factories and clothing factories in New England and New York as a way of getting around those union drives, moved their operations to the southern United States. Other factories in auto, really the expansion of auto factories in the South didn't happen until like the 1970s and 80s. It's a fairly recent phenomenon building on earlier industrial migration from the urban north to the rural South.
So was it seen then in the South as a big loss at all or any impact at all to say, no, thanks, we don't want to unionize?
Right. So from a Southern perspective, I mean, the election was relatively close. I think the vote was like 53% against, 47 in favor. So it wasn't a landslide by any stretch. There are quite a few workers in the plant who were presumably disappointed, who wanted the union to come in. They just didn't have a majority. For the majority opinion, as people are trying to figure out why a majority voted against it, part of it is just the scarcity of industrial unions in the South. There are so few Southern factories that are organized that there's no culture of unionization. There's no idea that industrial union is a thing, that if you work in a factory, it would be a union job, you'd have union protection and so forth. Beyond that vague sort of cultural lack of union connection, there's some stuff in the history of what unions have stood for. One of the hallmarks of the CIO that really distinguished it from the AFL back when they were separate federations in the 30s and 40s and early 50s was that AFL unions followed the same attitude towards segregation as the part of the country where the local was based. So if you were in a city where blacks and whites were segregated in other aspects of public life, then union locals would be segregated as well. Even in northern cities, this often happened. Cities like Cleveland, like Chicago, had segregated trade unions, one for black workers, one for white workers. The CIO, looking at factory structures, said it's ridiculous for us to discriminate. So this, among the other CIO accomplishments, the CIO was active in breaking down racial barriers in industrial employment. So when we're looking at where the CIO really kind of came to a head in the South, was through their effort beginning in 1945 with the end of World War II called Operation Dixie, where the CIO sought to organize the textile factories that had moved down there, the beginnings of the steel industry in the South in places like Birmingham, Alabama, and Richmond, Virginia. The CIO tried to organize Southern factories in industries where they had organized in the North, and they failed. They failed spectacularly because it was at that time when Jim Crow was the law of the land across the American South, it was easy for people who didn't want the union to say, well, look what the CIO has done in the North. It's amalgamation of the races, a scare term for people who are accustomed to this Jim Crow society. Factories, for that matter, in the South were predominantly white. There were relatively few black factory workers in Southern factories compared to auto plants, steel mills, paper mills, and the like in the northern United States. Factories in the North were much more integrated and had been since like the 19-teens. Southern factory workforces tended to be majority white. So they saw the CIO's whole MO as kind of a threat to the Southern way of life, and that was a big part of why they rejected Operation Dixie in the late 40s and early 50s. One of the things that's still under debate that people are trying to figure out is, was this behind the rejection of the UAW in Chattanooga in 2014? Is there a racial angle or not? Mm. Again, the journalism I've seen of it, the coverage that's come out there, is that it's not a slam dunk. It doesn't seem certain that that was a major factor. At the same time, people who are being interviewed are less and less likely to fess up to outward, you know, professing, no, absolutely, I don't want to work with people of a different race. The sentiments, if they're going to come out, they're often the sort of thing that comes out after long exchanges, and you sort of go back and interpret things and you say, wait, there's a little theme in here. Hmm. So that's one of the – it's a questionable context anyway. We're not totally sure that's what was going on.
We're talking with Jonathan Pollack. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. Auto workers in Chattanooga rejected the chance to unionize despite openness by Volkswagen to have them do so.
And we'd love to hear from you on this one. Are you surprised by their decision or not? What does it mean for the future of the United Auto Workers Union and labor in the South? You can share your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. We're taking a story out of the news and looking at its place in history with Jonathan Pollack, a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College.
Auto workers at a VW manufacturing plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, recently voted not to unionize. Is this an unusual move for labor in the South or not? If you were an auto worker here in Wisconsin and VW were to open a plant here, would you vote to unionize? Why or why not? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. John, labor unions have been under fire over recent years, and even 3 years ago today, our Capitol was on fire with protests after Scott Walker had introduced his idea for Act 10. Some politicians have worked to weaken, you know, unions in the public sphere, but in this case, we have a private company offering the opportunity for unionization. And why would politicians intervene in the private industry in this way?
Well, you're right. It's a really curious phenomenon. And what people are figuring is that there was a great deal of fear among industrialists in Tennessee and the politicians who represent them that VW would set some kind of precedent. That if there was a previously kind of unified front, that the South sort of built its brand as a region of the country in which to do business, it built its brand on cheap, ununionized labor. And if VW allowed its workers to organize, and if those workers were able to get higher pay and benefits and so forth, it would have this kind of ripple effect that the South in the years since, I'm going to say it's like the early 80s, right? I remember there were a couple of movies made about this, the really terrible Michael Keaton movie Gung Ho with a Japanese auto company in the South was kind of part of this trend. So for the last 30 years, this has been an ongoing trend. And the wage scales are kind of at a certain level across the board. If VW allowed unionization, if as part of that workers got a pay raise, this would kind of force other plants to keep pace. And the South's economic advantage, the advantage of cheaper labor that it promoted to other industries in the South and really around the world, there's a great deal of international trade in this, would possibly be in jeopardy. So I think that's where the impetus came from. That's why they saw fit to do it. Beyond, you know, on a deeper level, you know, one might argue that in the very individualist strain of American politics, this idea of the self-made man, that unions really kind of say, no, that doesn't actually work for a lot of people. That the idea of a union, and especially an industrial union, is that it kind of says, look, even if people are working jobs that don't require years of study and training, they're still entitled to some kind of decent wage. They still should have some power in negotiating the conditions under which they work and so forth. And if you allow the union in there, there are perhaps other ramifications of that, whether people take that cue, look at other workplaces, look at other areas of society, and say, wait a minute, individualism is not everything. There are other ways to go about running a state.
Hmm. Let's take a call. Jack in Belgium is on the line. Hi, Jack.
Hi. 3 points. One is, I think unions have outlived their usefulness. Most of the things that unions have fought for, the 40-hour work week and the safe working conditions and the like, are now law. Secondly, I don't think they represent the membership. You can see, like, the Michigan Teachers Union, who voted bad legally for the sex offender or whatever it was here recently, does tremendous damage to the membership. If, in fact, the membership would be polled, I doubt very much that they would agree that that would be wise use of the union's leverage. And in addition to that, the right to, you know, mandatory union dues, there's no accountability. Basically, if I were to bill you for services that you don't want, you would probably say, well, I'm not paying you. But with the union, basically with mandatory union dues, it really doesn't matter because whatever is decided, you get paid, you pay for. That's my 3 points. Thank you.
Thanks, Jack.
That's excellent. And that's, I mean, that's a classic refutation of what unions do. At the same time, I mean, I think, you know, I think from the UAW perspective, what they were arguing in Chattanooga and what's kind of a standard thing on union drives is that the 40-hour work week is kind of under attack, is that for a lot of people, that's not actually a thing. I mean, I know where I teach, the majority of my students work and many of them work more than 40 hours because they can't get enough hours at their job. They get 20 hours here, they get 20 hours there, they get 10 hours there. So while it's there, it's kind of constantly, it's being chipped away at. And what unions give people is sort of it's like a bigger power on their side of things to enforce laws that are kind of being eroded. As far as benefits in the workplace and so forth, unionized workplaces continue to have better benefit packages than people are able to negotiate on their own or purchase through other means. So while it's true that there are certainly way fewer workers organized during that time, that definitely a majority of state legislatures are kind of coming to that same conclusion. For actual people working in a particular plant, there's another side to it. As far as representing the membership. Unions are democratic organizations, and while there's certainly a long history of people who become apathetic toward their unions and allow people to remain in office long after they're really representing the workers' interests, I think it's a similar relationship between people in their union and people in their government more generally. We can talk about corruption in government, we can talk about corruption in unions, and the way you get around that is democracy, is you vote the bums out if there are people who are messing you up, if they're not representing you. And as far as dues go, the dues structures in unions are immensely complicated. This is something that unions spend a great amount of time on, the dues collected by all members, the mandatory membership, can only go to enforcing the contract. It can't be used for other things. If people opt in to donate to the union's political arm and so forth, that's their choice. But it goes to the upkeep and maintenance of the contract, to filing grievances when necessary, to hiring attorneys in the cases of people fired and so forth. So these are, I mean, again, these are longstanding arguments. These are arguments, some of the arguments that sank Operation Dixie back 60 years ago. But at the same time, there's still, you know, there's a reason for unions to exist according to their members. And while the abuses certainly take over the headlines, certainly the, you know, we can look at abuses in other fashions, abuses in religion, abuses in government, abuses in professions and so forth that really hog the spotlight.
Well, one question that I had posed to our listeners, and I'm going to toss it to you after we talk to one more listener, John, is if this issue were applied to Wisconsin, what outcomes might we see? Would we see the same thing that we saw in Chattanooga? But first, let's pose that question to Margie in Milwaukee. Margie, if this if the VW plant were to try to open in Wisconsin, would you vote for union membership?
Absolutely. And I probably would have said no 20 years ago. But to see what's happened with the relationship between business and the lower worker, it's really immoral. And I think in the past, what unions did do was give a better footing to employees to stand up against what was fair, what was right, what was safe in the workplace versus against the almighty dollar that is the push from upper management. And it's all of this happened in Tennessee really gives credibility to the arguments and the fears that came out when Walker did the Act 10 in Madison. Because
thanks, Margie. Let's give John a chance to respond here.
Yeah, I think I think Margie's point is consonant with the certainly with the hope of much of the labor movement You know, again, the Chattanooga case tells us that that a lot of workers are kind of agreeing with the first caller, perhaps more than the second one. But to get to the broader idea of what would happen in Wisconsin, you know, I gave kind of a big lecture to my students today about the danger of counterfactuals in history, and we're not totally, you know, we don't know. We're kind of making it up. But hey, it's 5:30 in the afternoon. We're on the radio. So what the heck? I think Wisconsin would have a very different experience. I mean, as the caller kind of alluded to there, the controversy over Act 10 brought a bunch of these labor issues into the spotlight for the first time in a very long time, that people really thought about them and talked about them at length. Additionally, the culture of unions in many Wisconsin cities, in Janesville, in Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee, Green Bay, lots of paper mill towns all over the state. People had firsthand knowledge of what unions were able to do for those communities, that unionized jobs were solid jobs. They were steady. You could count on them. As we move into a post-union era, that's no longer the case. And I think workers in Wisconsin would be less likely to reject the union than their counterparts in Tennessee.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us and helping us see this story through the lens of history.
Thank you very much.
It was John Pollack, a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He drops by every once in a while to help us put the news in context. It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out what it's like to compete in the longest and largest cross-country ski race in North America, the Birkebeiner. It takes place this weekend in Wisconsin.
First, a recent study claims to have new evidence that indicates tighter gun control laws can reduce gun violence.
The study looked at the data and statistics after the repeal of a 2007 law in Missouri, and the conclusions make a strong case that there's a correlation between weak firearm laws and increased gun violence.
Daniel Webster joins us now. He's one of the study's lead authors and the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, this study looked at the repeal of a 2007 gun control law in Missouri. What did that law say?
Well, the law was repealed in 2007, and prior to that, it had been in place since 1921. It was a law that required anyone who wanted to purchase a handgun to first apply for a permit through the local sheriff's office, where they would carefully do a background check and then issue a permit that would be good for a 30-day period in which someone could purchase a handgun. Importantly, this permit was required not only when someone wanted to buy a handgun from a licensed gun dealer, but also anyone who was selling a handgun, including unlicensed private sellers.
Why do we know why it was repealed?
Well, honestly, I don't know a lot about the whole political process in their decision to repeal, but, you know, many states, there are individuals and organizations that do not like gun control, and Missouri had actually a fairly robust system for regulating handguns prior to the repeal in 2007.
What did you observe? What happened after the law was repealed?
It was really quite striking. There was an immediate increase in firearm-related homicides in the state in the first full 3 years after the law was repealed. Firearm homicide rates increased by 25%. Now, what was even more striking is that this was against the national trend. At that same time period, the rest of the United States, firearm homicide rates were going down by more than 5%. And even if you looked regional, if you looked at all the states that surround and border Missouri collectively, they also were experiencing declines in firearm homicides. So it was a very large and sudden increase coincident with the repeal of this law that really was unique to Missouri.
Explain for a bit why your evidence or whether your evidence seems to indicate that the increase in the murder rate is a direct result of the repeal of these laws and not some other factor or even just a coincidence.
Sure. Well, of course, policy researchers don't have the ability or luxury to do randomized experiments like other scientists. So what we do is we do very careful analysis at changes in response to public policy, and we try to rule out alternative explanations. So if the law was causing this change that we observed, you would expect it only to affect homicides involving guns. That's precisely what we found. You would also expect that it would be an increase that was experienced throughout the state rather than perhaps a sudden big increase in one city, say St. Louis, if a gang war broke out or some failing of local law enforcement. But we saw this sudden increase throughout the state. And then we looked at other potential explanations. Could it be unemployment, changes in poverty rates, changes in policing levels, incarceration rates, or other changes in public policies? So we gathered data on all of those factors and statistically controlled for those factors. And there was still a very, very strong, highly statistically significant effect of the law that showed roughly 23% of the increase in firearm homicides attributable to the change in the policy.
Now, Missouri had also enacted a Stand Your Ground law the same year that these permit requirements were repealed. How did that throw a wrinkle in your research?
Yes, I'm glad you pointed that out. There were many states that were passing laws of this type during the study period of 1999 through 2012. And so we wanted to statistically control for those types of changes, including Missouri. So in essence, what you do is you account for the average effect that's going on all the states that are adopting these laws. And we still found this again, very large and statistically significant increase. Again, as policy researchers, we can't manipulate these factors. We just statistically control for them.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking a lot about Missouri, and in fact, much of the news coming out about your study looks at that. But did you look at other states in the country, and what states have similar laws and what have their statistics shown you?
Sure. So our study included data from all 50 states. So we were looking at how these trends were changing across all 50 states and wanted to see whether the change in Missouri was indeed unique at that time, and it clearly was. We also were examining other public policies and their impacts on homicides as well. Our prior research, we've been doing research on these policies for a long time, and we published two prior studies that looked at these laws as well as other laws like other ways to regulate private transactions and regulate firearm dealers. And we found consistently that the strongest effect for reducing the diversion of guns to criminals is through these permit-to-purchase licensing laws that require prospective purchasers to apply in person to a law enforcement agency.
What do you hope that policymakers take away from the study, if anything?
Well, I think it demonstrates the power of reasonable gun regulations to save lives. This is a type of policy that really does not take away anyone's gun who is a law-abiding citizen. Really has minimal effect on one's ability to purchase guns. It simply is does something that generally there's agreement across the board, whether you're a gun owner or not, which is we want to keep guns out of the wrong hands. And So Missouri was doing this quite effectively for a number of years, and when they decided to repeal that law, they did criminals a favor. They made it easier for them to get guns, and the result was more deaths.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Webster is the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research.
In Norway and Wisconsin, the race goes on. From Hayward to Telemark, to sing a song about the best in the world, about you and me, doing the Burka Bonner rag.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Festivities are getting underway today in northern Wisconsin as we approach the 41st annual Birkebeiner race. And that's the famous Birkebeiner rag you're hearing in the background.
The Birkie's a Wisconsin tradition, and not to mention the largest and longest cross-country ski race in North America. The 54-kilometer race, as well as some shorter events, bring about 10,000 skiers to the state each year. In today's edition of Curious Wisconsin, we find out what it's like to train for and compete in the American Birkebeiner.
Joining us now is Mike Ivey by day. He's a reporter at the Capital Times in Madison, but in his free time, he's an avid cross-country skier who's competed in numerous Birkebeiners. He'll be doing it again in just a couple of days. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, Mike, you are a total Birkebeiner nut. You're doing your 26th Birkebeiner this weekend, so I guess we got to ask you, why do you keep going back and doing it? What do you love about
it? It's a bad habit I can't shake. I started signing up for it and doing it, and then I think they kind of rope you in because after you do 20 Birkies, you get a special purple bib to wear during the race, and now when you hit 30, they give you a gold bib, so they keep throwing these milestones out there along the way.
So it's a purple bib.
Yeah, I'm a member of the Purple Bib Club. They call it the Birch Leggings Club. Birkebeiner actually is a Norwegian term for birch bark that goes over the top of your boots and pants, and according to Norwegian lore, 600 years ago, warriors dressed in that type of garb rescued the baby prince during the Norwegian Civil War, and that's sort of what started the whole tradition of the Birkebeiner.
Tell us a little bit about the race. How long is it, and how challenging for you?
Well, there's a couple of different events. They have a 54-kilometer classic style where you go with your ski side by side, and then they have the 50-kilometer freestyle race, which is more of a skating technique. If you watch some of the skiing on the Olympics on TV or the biathletes, you'll see those guys sort of look like they're almost, skating on their skis. And it's a hard race to do because it's so hilly is one of the things about the Birkie course, up and down. So it can be a long, grueling day out there. I'll tell you what everybody's talking about right now is this giant winter storm that seems to be bearing right down on Hayward, where the race finishes, and I would assume most of the Birkie skiers are kind of glued to their computers getting the recent weather update, but they're predicting anywhere from 10 to 15 inches of snow tonight and into tomorrow morning. So that's going to make it difficult to get the course packed down. And
so that's bad news for the skiers, a lot of snow?
Yeah, because it really slows things down when the snow's too deep. I mean, I think a lot of skiers would rather have it fast with the snow packed down. I like it hard and icy and fast. I mean, I've been doing it a long time. But I think it's going to be a long slug, mashed potatoes, if you can imagine skiing through mashed potatoes, because when that many skiers go over the course, they really tend to churn it up.
How do you train for a race like this?
Well, I think for a lot of people, it becomes a real part of their lifestyle. They maybe bicycle in the summer or do runs or people paddle. And I think the Birkie tries to sell it as a whole year-round lifestyle thing that you're not really, you got that Birkie out there looming in the future at some point. So it's a way to, keep you going and keep outside. I mean, some people are really super serious about it and go to clinics and kind of devote a good part of their life to having a great time. And I think back before I had kids and was a younger guy, I was probably a little more gung-ho about it. Now I'm, I try and get out when I can and just enjoy really being out there with your friends. It's sort of like a family reunion in a way. I run into people I only see once a year, and I'll see them at the Birkie, and they have moved to California or to Washington, D.C. or wherever, and then I'll just, hey, I'll run into them at the finish area. It's one of Wisconsin's really great traditions, and I think one reason that people do enjoy the quality of life we have here.
Well, as someone who's never skied in a race, let alone the Birkebeiner, I've done some cross-country skiing, but I'm curious because I gather there's, you know, something like upwards of 1,000 skiers who do this. What is it like?
10,000 skiers.
10,000 skiers. Okay. So what is it like when you're on the trail, you're skiing from Hayward to the Telemark Lodge and Cable, which I gather is closed now, but that's where you're skiing.
It goes the other way. It starts at Telemark and finishes on downtown Hayward. They cover the main street with snow. But what it's like is cross-country skiing, most people think of a sort of a solitary thing. You're out in the woods by yourself. The Berkey is the complete opposite. You're never by yourself.
So are you chit-chatting along the way and exchanging bits of gossip, or are you just focused in?
Well, I would say the guys up in the front are probably breathing too hard to do much chit-chatting. But as you as people sort of spread out as you do it more, I think there's quite a bit of chit-chatting. And then there's rest stops along the way, so there's 7 or 8 stops with warming fires, and they provide hot drinks for the skiers and bananas and donuts and stuff like that to, you know, sort of keep your energy up. And there's a fair amount of camaraderie out there. I would say that people are nobody's trying to really knock each other down too much. I mean, there's some guys that get maybe a little too excited, but for the most part, I think people realize it's a fun thing, and it's they're all out there together, kind of testing ourselves and try and make sure everybody has a good time.
Would you say that a good number of these people that are competing alongside of you are amateur athletes, or are they just enjoy the cross-country skiing?
It really depends where you start, because they have these different waves depending on your previous year's finish time. So, like, the real fast people end up in the front, wave one, or the elite wave for almost, Olympic-caliber type people. And then as you go farther back, people are slower and slower, so they probably are a little more, it's not quite as competitive in the back. So it really, it's something that everybody can do. I think a lot of people, maybe that's the only ski race they do all year. Then whereas you get the guys up in the front, they might be doing a ski race every weekend. They're sort of on the circuit. So it really runs the gamut. Plus they have a shorter race that's only 23 kilometers called the Kortaløpet. I think that's Norwegian for short race. And they even have a 12-kilometer race. And then the few days leading up to the event, they have other stuff like a short kids race and some other events, that kind of fun thing. So there's really something for everybody if you're not up for doing the whole 50-kilometer thing.
Now, you talked a little bit about the history of the Birkebeiner. It took originally, the name came from a Norwegian event where a couple of skiers were trying to smuggle a prince to a different city in Norway through some mountains. And I gather that in Norway, some of the skiers will still carry a pack on their back to symbolize this 18-month-old. Do people do that up in Hayward?
No, I've never seen. Actually, if they're going to go to Norway and do it, Norway still has their own Birkebeiner, and to do that, you need to carry a pack that simulates the weight of the prince. That's just sort of how crazy that one is. Hmm. The American Birkebeiner was actually started by the founder of Telemark Resort, the late Tony Wise, as sort of a tourism draw. And if you remember back to in the 70s, skiing sort of was really taking off here as part of the running fitness boom. So he said, hey, here's a way to get the people to come up to my resort. So he started this race. And it used to go the other way from Hayward to Telemark and ended at his resort. And he said, I'll drum up a bunch of business. And then it really took off. And it's become the largest, like you were saying, the largest cross-country ski race in North America.
How long does it take you to actually finish this 54-kilometer journey?
Boy, back when I was a younger guy, I think my fastest time was maybe 2 hours, 35 minutes. And then, probably, I've been getting slower as I get older. So I'm hoping this year with all that slow snow, I think around 4 hours it'll probably take me to do it. But the winter, I think the record time is right around 2 hours. So, and then some people take, I think you can take up to 8 hours. They'll kick you out if you're too slow. If you get to the end, they'll say, you haven't hit the time limit. But people go, what's fun is at the end, people in Hayward are all standing out. It's like a huge party on Main Street, cheering everybody as they come in. And skiers keep streaming in, right up till 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
Now, what do you do when you get to the finish line typically? Do you fall down and or do you just have a beer and a steak or something?
Some fall down, but usually the first thing you want to do is take off those wet, soggy ski socks and change your clothes. And then they have a giant tent set up with food available and everything. And then a lot of people sort of end up filtering down to the taverns that are on both sides of the street in Hayward, and it becomes a pretty a giant party. I think people in Hayward, it's their single largest tourism day of the year is Berkey Saturday. So it's a huge tourism event for northern Wisconsin, not just Hayward, but all the little motels, and people, stay, hopefully within an hour or so they get to the race start. Giant traffic jam that day, too. It's just going to be, I don't know what it's going to be like with all the snow they're predicting, if they're going to get all the roads open and everything. Fortunately, the snow's coming on Thursday and not Friday.
So you got a day to clear out?
I think so.
What's your best advice that you can offer to cross-country skiers who might be considering the race?
Don't go out too hard. Take it easy. I always say, if you're sweating, you're going too hard. That's my attitude about it. So I've learned it's a lot more fun to take your time and stop at the aid stations and everything. And I would say get in some, you want to get in some hills, because that's the main thing at the Berkey is the hills. The ups are tough, but as you get to the back, so many people have gone down, they sort of start to snow plow the snow away, and you end up with these giant troughs, like two or three skiers wide across the hills. And it's almost kind of like going down a snow tubing chute. And you've got to watch for people falling in front of you. I remember when I did my first Berkey, I had to start way in the back. I must have fallen 15 times or so. And I remember one time falling and trying to ski over one of those humps. And
wow,
crashing.
It sounds like an adventure. But, Mike, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for being with us and good luck.
Thanks.
Mike Ivey is a reporter at the Capital Times. He'll be competing in his 26th Berkebeiner this weekend.